Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. Today, an unbelievably special treat. We have Whitney Webb, known to all of you, I know, but I'm just going to mention it again. She's a researcher, a journalist, and as Joe McCullough just said on a recent interview when I did, one of, if not the top investigative journal of our, a journalist of our time. She's written for many websites. For years, she was a staff writer and a senior investigative reporter for Mint Press News. She's the contributing editor of Unlimited Hangout, which is a site I strongly recommend, and author of a 2-volume book, which we also recommended, and Whitney joined us to discuss. If you haven't gotten it, you have to get it. It's called One Nation Under Blackmail, and it's very much about the criminal syndicates we're all grappling with in terms of global and domestic governance. So, Whitney, I know you've been exceptionally busy with family matters recently, but we're really excited that you've written this piece on AI and are joining us today. The title of your piece, The AI Revolution, The Final Coup d'Etat. So first of all, welcome and thank you for doing this.
Great to be here. Thanks so much, Catherine, and for the opportunity to contribute formally to your publication. Definitely.
So tell us when you first got interested in AI.
Honestly, I'm not really exactly sure when that was, but I think it was sort of a natural thing because the line of my work for a long time has been very much focused on Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley intelligence connections more specifically. So definitely by 2018, 2019, I was getting a lot more into that. But previously, you know, before writing for Unlimited Hangout or The Last American Vagabond, I worked for Mint Press News, and they have a major focus on focus and have for a long time on the Israel-Palestine issue. And so I did write a lot about the Israeli tech sector and their overlap with intelligence, which invariably has a lot to do with their collaborations with U.S. intelligence. And really both countries have sort of a binational national security state. There's a lot of collaboration and obviously between U.S. and Israeli intelligence, and both of those intelligence communities are very invested and have a very dominant presence, I think you could say, in the tech sectors of both of those countries, in Israel, you know, Israel and the U.S. Sometimes it's hard to tell where intelligence ends and, you know, Silicon Valley in the U.S., begins really, and then, you know, ditto for Israel and, you know, their cybersecurity and some of their other prominent tech sectors. So I just have to say,
you know, as somebody who watched Silicon Valley in the early days go from entrepreneurs who are excited about the possibility of this technology, I mean, it pretty much became an expression of the intelligence agencies and the military complex. Mm-hmm. And if you go out to Silicon Valley and you kind of walk around and look at who's, you know, it's an integrated picture. They try very hard from branding to describe themselves as being private market companies, but they're not only deeply the creation and creatures of the intelligence and military agencies, but their profitability is entirely dependent on it. So
totally.
If you look at where their profits are coming from, if you look at where their orders are coming from, there is no separation. You know, and that's why we have
absolutely
this,
and I think really that's from the beginning. You know, there's been this myth making that's gone on in Silicon Valley specifically for a very long time to sort of paint all of these now titans of tech in the United States as having begun their trajectory to where they are today as having, you know, they were tinkering around in their garages and all of this stuff. And the more you look into it, the more that's, you know, obvious fiction.
There was a lot of the technology that was laundered out of the black budget into these private companies for a variety of reasons. They wanted to develop it in separate private companies and have it look non-governmental.
Yeah, and I think there was a big push to do that specifically. That push really began in earnest around the early 2000s, I'd say 2002, 2003 or so, because in the post 9/11 era, you had this big push coming from DARPA specifically, which for a long time is where military and intelligence have met, to produce a mass surveillance program called Total Information Awareness. And there was a huge pushback from mainstream media, the New York Times, Washington Post, what have you, and also Congress and the ACLU and a lot of other organizations, a very negative pushback against that particular program because the military was going to run it. And they essentially, with the help of Peter Thiel, rebranded that program as what is now Palantir. And no one complained when it was a completely private operation. They realized that if they took the military overtly out of the equation, people would complain less and look at it as sort of an excess of capitalism or surveillance capitalism and not as, you know, intended a surveillance dragnet run by the military industrial intelligence complex, right? And since then, it's all been privatized. You could even argue, as I have in past pieces, that Facebook, you know, after Peter Thiel did this for the people running this DARPA program and privatized it, he became the money man that brought us Facebook, which is essentially analogous to another DARPA program that was defunded along with Total Information Awareness. And a lot of the surveillance infrastructure has also been, you know, they followed that same model. And I think it's very possible as well, if you're looking at recent developments with the US in terms of like a CBDC or a digital dollar, it's likely to have a lot of privatization components, at least in the US, so they can say, oh, it's not direct issue, it's not the government, but you know, if it's JP Morgan or Citigroup with their deposit tokens, you know, at the end of the day, it's still programmable money and you get the same system, but they can say it's private and that we're not doing it the way maybe China would do it, but at the end of the day, it's the same authoritarian system.
So I just want to point out one thing. Normally, when a company starts and grows, it grows because it serves the customer, and its economics and its management revolve around being economically relevant to that customer. And it's important to understand that big tech didn't grow up around the consumer. It grew up around the customer was the intelligence agencies and the military, and the money was a tsunami of money that didn't require economic performance. It just required, in other words, they're being paid to build a control machinery, a surveillance and control machinery, and money is no object. And it doesn't have to be economically relevant to the consumer, because the consumer is not really the consumer. The consumer is the prey.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair to say. And there's a reason why a lot of the rise of these Silicon Valley companies overlaps considerably with when the CIA created NQTEL, for example.
Right. Right.
And there was this push to pour, you know, intelligence money more directly into a bunch of these, you know, companies that we have today that, you know, essentially are running most, if not everything. And then you, of course, have a few exceptions of companies that existed before that, Microsoft and Oracle, for example. But, you know, essentially focused on the same model even before then. So Oracle, for example, is named for Project Oracle, on which the Oracle co-founders worked on at the CIA before creating Oracle, the company. And it's been focused on databases just like Project Oracle was. And essentially, you know, a lot of these companies have known for a long time through their collaboration with intelligence and have had like the incentive to harvest as much and control as much data as possible. And you don't just have NQTEL overlapping with a lot of this bustling activity in Silicon Valley, but also a post 9/11 push to consolidate all of the data that is sucked up by the national security state into a single massive database, or at least several databases that are interlinked and accessible to anyone. And now we have, of course, you know, the AI component there, that all AI is being trained on that data and, you know, using it for their, you know, seeking to use it for various ends. And you can argue that was, you know, part of the impulse behind this mass harvesting of data was to trigger some sort of event in artificial intelligence, because, you know, concurrently with a lot of even the early big tech companies, you know, AI has been developing in a lot of these same circles, and these push for supercomputers and things in the 70s and 80s. You know, there's a lot of connections there. And that actually ends up coming up in my book a lot when I talk about, you know, the technology aspect of the quote unquote Epstein network.
Right.
Just lots of overlap.
So let's step back and say, what is AI? Because if you look at what AI is, it translates into thousands, if not millions, of applications. So there's a very long tail in terms of what it is. But maybe if we could just define for purposes of this conversation, what is AI? And if you call it the final coup, why do you call it the final coup?
Well, I call it the final coup because of the big push to put AI in charge of governance sooner rather than later. In terms of defining what AI is for the purpose of this conversation, I mean, obviously there's a lot of ways to define it. I would essentially say it's a technology that uses data and information it extracts from living creative beings and then imitates that. And is essentially an imitation of, I guess, us. And there's an attempt that is coming to convince people that this imitation is equivalent and superior to organic intelligence, meaning human intelligence. And that because of that, we should put it in charge of everything. That's essentially the narrative that is coming. And, you know, for anyone that's followed the recent hoopla with OpenAI and the drama over their now again CEO, Sam Altman, you know, this was allegedly, that whole thing was allegedly spurred by a research program called Q-Star, which, you know, makes me think of QAnon. For some reason, but it's basically was allegedly going to threaten humanity because it there was some sort of alleged discovery about artificial general intelligence, or AGI, which in these same spheres is sometimes referred to in overtly religious terms as the singularity, which is the point where AI intelligence supersedes human intelligence.
So I just want to step back and mention, because, you know, it's a very interesting discussion that we're not going to spend a lot of time on today, but what software and computers can do is they can process a lot of stuff fast.
Yes.
So they can read more, process more, mm-hmm. and do certain kinds of analysis much faster than a human. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they start with something that's zero and one. And to me, the notion that human intelligence can be unpacked down to zero and one is completely absurd.
Yes, well, I agree. But you have to keep in mind, too, that a lot of these people designing these systems, at least at the very top, are very materialist in the sense that I wouldn't say they don't necessarily believe in anything beyond the material, but they think that this is the most important of the planes, I guess you could say.
So I would say they're basically ignorant about the majority of reality.
And of consciousness, right? Think that they are going to be able to completely control consciousness and create it from nothing and, you know, become the new immortal gods, essentially. You know, there's a weird push for that among these like Silicon Valley elites. Like you have people like Larry Page, for example, the Google co-founder, completely obsessed with immortality. And a lot of these other guys that I mentioned earlier, Peter Thiel, for example, also obsessed with living forever. They want to be cryogenically frozen and unfrozen and cyborged and inject young people blood into themselves. I know that sounds really crazy, but that's an actual startup.
They're absolutely doing it. They're absolutely doing it.
I think that speaks to this obsession with the material plane, because if they wanted to stay here forever, I mean, they obviously are, you know, view this as the most important of life, right? And seek to dominate it from here. And I think, you know, for people that look at what's going on as, you know, a spiritual war and whatnot, you know, this overt materialist focused effort to not just discount, but also sever humanity from every other plane. But this one, I think, speaks to, you know, a lot of, you know, how they operate and how they think. And I think ultimately, you know, it points to them not being able to succeed. But, you know, if you also consider, you know, I guess from the Christian perspective that, you know, if you want to define this Satanism, you know, that's essentially gross extreme materialism as well. So, right. You know, for people that use those terms to describe, you know, these ambitions, you know, I certainly think that, you know, within those contexts, it's not inaccurate to use it.
You start off in your piece and you look at sort of three characters. You look at Thiel, you look at Schmidt, and you look at Kissinger. And you go back and look at some of the things they've written and said about their approach and what they think this means. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I basically started off talking about the two, I mean, most obvious, I guess, front men, I would say, that dominate Silicon Valley. And it's really comes down to what I would label as the faction dominate or led more or less by Peter Thiel. And you would have like Elon Musk and people like that in that sphere as well. And then on the other side, you have Eric Schmidt, who's very aligned himself very much with Henry Kissinger. And you have a lot of the former guys that led NQTEL, Gilman Louie, for example, being very close to Schmidt. And, you know, essentially now with the Biden administration, Schmidt is running pretty much the entire science and technology policy and has been since Biden came to office. And you could argue that he was also dominating it under Obama as well. And then during the Trump era, it was more Thiel-centric figures that were in charge because of Peter Thiel's outsized role on Trump's transition team. But with the Biden administration, you have Schmidt, essentially, who for people that don't know him, by the way, is the former longtime CEO of Google and its parent company, Alphabet. He's been funding top officials at the Department of Transportation, the Department of Energy, I forget the exact name, but the Office of Science and Technology Policy at the White House, the Federal Trade Commission. I mean, pretty much everything that involves science, the National or Federal Academy of Scientists, I think it's called. I mean, all of these different organizations completely dominated by Schmidt and Schmidt Futures and his nonprofits. And the actually mainstream media has reported on this quite extensively, Politico in particular, and nothing has happened. I mean, you even have the general counsels of a lot of these different departments being like the conflicts of interest with Eric Schmidt are very nothing happens. And it's because precisely we are being led down a path where the American people are being or consent is being manufactured to move us away from democracy. And you could argue that for a long time, democracy in the US has not actually existed, but now it's going to formally go away. And to use AI as part of this.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to point out that what has been happening over the last 20 years, but certainly accelerating, is that the government is being run day to day by corporate contractors. So the lead corporate contractor for the government is Lockheed Martin, which has a big installation out in Silicon Valley, I would point out. They also have a big one next to Disney World. But in addition, we just saw the issuance of the what used to be called the Jedi contract, but now they've changed the name, whereby the entire cloud of DOD and the Pentagon have been outsourced essentially to four firms. One of which is Microsoft, one of which is Amazon, one of which is Oracle, one of which is Google. And meantime, all 17 intelligence agencies have their cloud in a joint cloud through Amazon. Mm-hmm. And of course, all these can be integrated on the back end and AI can be applied to all the data. So it's an incredible source. Essentially, all the federal government data is in the back end of what I call the data beast. And all these firms have their snout directly into the data beast.
Well, what you've seen over the past several years is an overt fusion valley in the national security state. And as we talked about a little bit earlier, the national security state was at the origins of all of this all of these companies, but now it's overt. And you can, you know, all of the big tech companies are contractors to the national security state. The money is all mixed together. The business and the data are all mixed together. And then you have top Silicon Valley figures being the main contributors to political campaigns, or in the case of Eric Schmidt, directly paying the salaries of officials in the Biden administration. You know, it's very clear that we are no longer in a democratic paradigm, as a lot of Americans would like to think of it. You know, it's Silicon Valley and the national security state fused together. They're a blob. Think of it and call it.
Or a Borg. So, I would just point out the stock market. There has been a dramatic bifurcation between this Borg or blob. You know, the blob has been significantly outperforming everybody else. And it's because of the power equation. In other words, they've got an infinite amount of money being printed essentially by the central bank on an uneconomic basis, but it's driving their stocks way up because it looks like they've got the power bit in their teeth and are running with it. So they're building the control grid.
Yeah, they definitely are. I mean, I think, again, it was by design. That's why you have the national security state here from the off, because a lot of these ambitions to create this system that's now coming into view and has been coming into several years, the plans for this go back to like the late 70s and the 80s, arguably earlier with the creation of the internet, if you're familiar with Yasha Levine's right. book, Surveillance Valley, and what right. intelligence was looking to create during the Vietnam War. And the use of technology in dissident hunting programs like the Phoenix program, for example.
Right.
It's been a long road to get here, and they've been very patient. And now we're sort of seeing the fruits of their efforts. And unfortunately, even people that can see it are still very willing to lend their data to these technologies, which essentially, you know, the only way to really fight it effectively is to fully divest from it, at least as much as right. as one can. Yeah. And right. so a key component of all of their machinations here is related to dependency and our dependency on their technology, and not necessarily the technology itself, but the versions of those technologies that they produce and sell. Right. So there's a right. lot of like open source alternatives, for example, to Microsoft Word, to Google Docs, you know, different internet browsers, different operating systems. There's alternatives to all the ones dominated by big tech. It's not necessarily a game of we have to return to the pre-technology era, but we certainly have to divest from these companies as much as possible. But there's, you know, even in independent media, there's a lack of willingness to do that just because of the convenience, which again is... you know, I talk about a lot in my work, particularly on this issue. The convenience is what they think will keep us in line for, you know, essentially forever. And it's the way to sort of herd us into this corral, is that we want to keep doing things the easy way and not have to figure out how to do any of this stuff ourselves and remain dependent on these companies for increasingly everything. I mean, it's a lot now, but they plan to have it be literally
the
everything.
Open source products are getting better and better, though, and
it's
so
true.
The alternatives are getting better and better, and but I agree with you. I've always been shocked at how the new media doesn't seem to understand, and we will always, as a matter of principle, we'll say, somebody will say, well, we're going to do this on Google, and I say, well, we won't use Google for security reasons, so I guess we're not
totally.
Joining you. So I, you know, we just have to say no, we refuse. Okay, so At some point, you bring in Harari and the World Economic Forum in your piece, The Final Coup. So tell us about, we go from Kissinger and Schmidt and Thiel into sort of the global marketing of this stuff.
Right. So in talking about these power factions, you know, as I said a little bit ago, Schmidt is really, I see Schmidt and Kissinger sort of like the dominant architects of AI policy as it is today, and not just them, but the faction they lead, right? And so Kissinger and Schmidt, along with an MIT professor named Guttenlocher, wrote a book in 2021 called The Age of AI, Our Human Future, which if you read between the lines is essentially soft disclosure of what they plan to actually use it for. And so right. a lot of it has to do essentially entirely about using AI to control people's perception of reality and to cognitively diminish people by allowing their brains and ability to perceive to atrophy, essentially by outsourcing all of this to AI. That in that context, there will be one of two outcomes. And Schmidt overtly said this in an interview with the Hoover Institution. You know, the AI revolution, as he calls it, will lead to one of two outcomes. Either the elite will be overthrown, which, big surprise, is the outcome these guys don't want, right? And the other outcome, they say, is the creation of a new religion, meaning an AI-centric religion. And, you know, in discussing that and the push for that, you know, if you look at Silicon Valley in this weird space, I call it weird because it's certainly weird to me, but I guess not to them. There is already this push for an AI-centric religion. You have one figure in Silicon Valley, I forget his name, who's created an AI-based church called The Way of the Future or something like that. You have ChatGPT writing sermons for various churches in the United States and the West. But, you know, in the context of Harari, he's one of the architects of a religious system, I guess you could say, that he refers to, and other people as well refer to, as dataism, which is essentially, I guess, in a sense, the worship of data. But it's the idea that instead of a human centric or God centric religion, it's all about the free flow of data and information, and that everything in the universe and physical world must be connected to a information sharing system. I mean, essentially recreating consciousness and the idea of, you know, we are all one and there's something that connects all living things, some force that connects, some creative force that connects all living things, and that there's some sort of, you know, there's a flow of consciousness and information inherent to that. They want to create a materialist system that mimics that, essentially. And, you know, Harari overtly says that even those that don't want to be connected will be connected. Heretics of dataism will be forcibly connected, because it's not about free will or human decision making or human search for enlightenment or looking to from the material plane to the spiritual plane. It's about the flow of this information, the flow of data at all costs. And right, that's essentially what this.
The data that they're planning on feeding the machine is very much manipulated and controlled by a small group of humans. So it's it doesn't mimic a consciousness. It mimics an official narrative consciousness.
Exactly. Well, right. You know, if you think of these groups, you know, one of the sayings that has followed them around for a long time is order out of chaos, right? And I think if you look at it that way, they're looking for a version of existing consciousness that they view as ordered and not chaotic. Because for them, human creativity, for example, they see as impulsive and chaotic and not necessarily easy to predict. They want something that AI can predict easily for them and control for them. And they need AI in charge of essentially human perception, the human perception of reality at a mass level, in order to accomplish that. So they're essentially seeking to recreate life, but in a way that they can order it, I guess, for lack of a better term.
What you're talking about is using AI as a cover story.
In a sense, yes. But I think they, again, you know, AI is about extracting and imitating. So it's to take up into a reality of created by this imitation, right? So in a sense, it is a cover for some things. You know, I think definitely as AI is now, there's a definite concerted effort to use it as a sort of Wizard of Oz style device or tool.
So once upon a time, we had something called markets. And where markets are allowed to work, they're remarkably economic at when the pricing systems are honest. They do a tremendous job of communication of what people want and preferences, you know, at great distances at high speed on a very economic basis. But the problem is, you know, it's hard to control. And there's been a lot of effort to use digital technology to manipulate and control markets in a way that would feed central control. But if you look at now what they're proposing to do with AI, it completely replaces the whole market system with something that is much easier to engineer and centrally control from behind the scenes. In other words, it's a bigger, better lie than a manipulated market. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think, yes. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that lie too is that there's going to be these different companies, but really at the end of the day, just like digital ID and all these other systems they're trying to roll out right now, there's going to be different apparent players or different vendors, but they're all going to be interoperable at the end of the day and ultimately the same centralized entity globally. And I think, you know, with AI, it's pretty clear that that's the intention. And there's also an effort from you know, essentially every government in the world and also the United Nations to put AI increasingly in charge of governance, as well as control over, you know, the internet in terms of what information people are allowed to access and see. And that's why you're seeing AI playing already and has been for years an outsized role in censorship. But now, not just censorship, but also content creation. Right. The idea is that by 2025, the vast majority of content on the internet will have been generated by generative AI like ChatGPT. And so how much what we're consuming on the internet anymore is even from real people. You know, it's becoming increasingly less, and that's by design. You know, they want us to only interact and consume information generated by this technology and become dependent on it to tell us what to, you know, believe and think. And through that, control our perception of events. To the point where gradually, as they chart out in this book, we will not be able to determine reality for ourselves. The idea is to outsource our perception of everything to artificial intelligence and also our decision making, not just on the personal level, but also on the governmental level. And we're going to be told, because the narrative's already there, that AI is so superior that we should put it in charge of everything. Like, for example, OpenAI's chief scientist has explicitly said that there's the ideal for him and his company is to have generative AI run the government. So I think it's no coincidence, for example, that, you know, with the Israel-Palestine conflict being such big news, you had the UN recently contract a company to contract an AI digital twinning firm to solve the Israel-Palestine conflict. So by making a digital twin of every Palestinian and deciding how they can get them to consent to their own, you know, elimination and erasure of their sovereignty, you know, what buttons they can push for those ends. And then there's peace, you know. There's a lot of pushes in all these different directions to have AI increasingly, you know, I guess, take over more and more roles of governance. And I think also, you know, because so many people are using ChatGPT, it'll cost nothing for generative AI to come across and portray itself to people as, you know, a peacemaker, and look at all these solutions it proposes. And don't these sound like good ideas, especially when you have our talking head politicians being increasingly polarized on both sides of the divide, saying things that sound, you know, warmongery and bellicose, you know, just really intense rhetoric. And then you'll have AI come in the middle and be like, let's find middle ground, guys. I mean, I think that's the psyop that they're setting up to try and get people to consent to the idea that AI will be great for global governance, and it will be so peaceful to have a society run by AI. But at the end of the day, and a critical point that's made in this book that I found, you know, even surprising from the soft disclosure standpoint, is that there's going to be two classes of people: the people that run and program and tweak the AI, and then the people that AI acts upon. Right. And this is essentially the techno-feudal paradigm that has come up in my work for years now, where these people that dominate AI and are needed to maintain and create and program it and alter it or meet its needs will be in one class, and they'll understand what AI is doing and have different privileges. And then the people that AI acts upon that don't understand what's happening and eventually will lose their ability to understand what's happening. That's essentially what's laid out there.
If you look at the people that AI is acting upon, it's basically an extraction tool. So it's extracting data, it's extracting value, it's using that information to take more, you know, out of the fee flow, out of the, you know, the financial extraction exchange. And it's basically, you know, making one portion wealthier while it's destroying the wealth of the others. And mm-hmm. so you see this, you know, it's like a mining operation.
Yeah.
And once
exactly it, is
once it's mined what it can mine, then the people that it's mined become expendable, and out they go.
Yeah.
And
money,
so I don't,
power, and data is being harvested from this, what is going to become this massive underclass, and it's happening. It's very, it's happening very quickly. It's really only escalating. And the people getting all of that power and money are the technocratic elite, which is the national security state, Silicon Valley blob, the people that run that.
Right. And they run it.
At the same time, people, key people in that blob, like Elon Musk, are being held up to us as heroes and people that we should look to and, you know, let them run the world because they're so smart. He's like Tony Stark from Iron Man. Just put him in charge of everything. You know, I mean, that's essentially the setup here.
Well, one of the things that's important to understand is that the machinery is not economic. In other words, the people who are gaining in power and wealth are not gaining in power and wealth because they're doing something that's productive or more economic.
Sure.
They're gaining in power and wealth because they're extracting. And
they're stealing, essentially.
Right. They're stealing. And they're using taxpayers' money to finance that stealing. But as they do, I don't see any way that this can become other than a genocide machine. Because if you have a system that's fundamentally not economic, but is extracting more and more and more, including from the productive, the only way you can keep the economics going is to liquidate people.
Yeah.
You liquidate environment, you liquidate living things, you liquidate people.
Well, I think it's for that same reason that a lot of the people directing this system into existence also are very much very vocal about overpopulation and the need to have a smaller amount of people on the planet. Not necessarily for environmental reasons, though that seems to be the justification they use most often now, but for the purpose of how large does the herd need to be for the system that they're creating? It doesn't need to be as large as it is now by any means.
Right.
They need people, but not nearly as many people as are on the planet right now. And
so one of the things that one of the fundamental characteristics of AI is the thing that makes for a great AI program is not the software developers. It's the amount of data.
It's the amount of data and the speed with which it analyzes and produces a response to that data.
Right. So that's part of the drive to suck up as much data as, I mean, if you look at the desire to vacuum clean and not only vacuum clean, but create to digitize everything and then to vacuum clean the data. It's like a gold rush. It's frightening. But that's why, because the more data you suck up into your machine, the better your machine. And if you know, what we're talking about is a few people, a few companies, and a few countries basically sucking up the whole planet into a highly centralized machinery. I mean, this is the ultimate tool of centralization.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities to the industrial era and the era of like the oil barons and all of that. And it's no coincidence that families like the Rockefellers that sort of developed the model that took, you know, that has been sort of driving a lot of things up to now are also very involved in what's going on right now in a huge way. And essentially, you know, you have this catchphrase that's been going around for the better part of the last decade, that data is the new oil. And so the people that control the data are going to be the data barons of the modern era. And, you know, obviously we can see who some of those people hope to be, not to pick on Elon Musk, but he's definitely a very obvious one because Tesla, you know, isn't really a car company. It's a software company, but a software company that's going to be in every car in the U.S. most likely, because they're so far ahead of the market, thanks to government subsidies. And also because of his efforts to turn Twitter into the everything app, which is not only going to be a dominant social media site as it is now and a dominant media site as he's tried to make it more recently, but also half of the financial system or more than half. That's going to be a lot of data, especially if it does succeed in becoming the everything app and people are using it for everything. Their data for everything will be under Musk's control.
I always find it phenomenal that people want me to think well of somebody who wants to stick a mesh network in the back of my head and hook me up to the satellite.
Yeah, a lot of people like to forget about the brain chip aspect of Elon Musk, but I think they do so at their own peril.
Right. I couldn't agree more. Okay, so let's talk about CBDC and digital IDs, because once you, you know, I liken the digital concentration camp. We've built three sides of the corral, but digital IDs and CBDCs basically throw up the fourth wall and you're locked in.
Yeah.
And the thing that really locks you in, I don't know if you've seen that 1 minute video of Carson's from the BIS talking about make the rules and we can enforce them centrally. What he's talking about is we can make the rules and we can enforce them centrally in a highly centralized way because we will have AI to do it.
Exactly.
Because the power of CBDC and CBDC and fast payment systems and digital ID, you know, you don't realize what you're really dealing with until you throw AI into the mix. And then suddenly, pow, you see what you've got, which is a complete control system. It overrides every law, every rule, every suddenly the guy who controls that system can tell you everything about what you can do and how you can do it and when you can do it and why you can do it. You're talking about a highly centralized, complete control machinery.
Yeah. So in the next few years, there's going to be a crisis or a series of crises that onboard everyone, they hope, or as many people as possible, the vast majority of the world, onto digital ID and CBDC systems that will be interoperable at the end of the day. Whether they're run by the private or public sector, it's irrelevant. It's all a global public-private partnership. As we talked about earlier with the population reduction component here, AI is ultimately in charge of culling the herd. Once you have everyone on this system of digital ID and CBDCs and all of this, and especially, you know, with plans for a large war and, you know, upending the supply chain and all of this, you know, look no further than India and their digital ID system, where, you know, something happens with your digital ID. The system decides that you're not allowed to have your rice ration or food ration, and then you just don't have it. Right. So AI is going to, it already has a file on essentially everyone. It's going to, you know, it's programmable money. You can buy this, you can't buy that. You do the wrong thing, you're locked out of your own bank account. You can no longer purchase. Or, you know, a lot of, they want to have, the UN has already really put linked humanitarian aid to all of these systems, particularly through the World Food Program in their building block system, where you have to scan your eyeball in order to get humanitarian assistance. Especially everybody that can't feed themselves, which is the vast majority of people. And so AI is going to look over all of the data tied to you and decide if you get to make the cut or not. Are you obedient enough? Do you have the characteristics that the elite want for their data herd? If you do, then I guess you'll be allowed to stick around. And if you don't, then you won't.
Yeah, it's an algorithm. Are you worth more alive than dead?
Exactly. And this algorithm already exists in Silicon Valley philanthropy. It's called effective altruism. And people may have heard about this during the FTX debacle, because Sam Bankman-Fried was one of the faces of effective altruism. But the people that run that movement or dominate it are still very much at large, are directing a lot of what's going on right now. One of them, probably one of the biggest names in effective altruism, is Dustin Moskovitz, the co-founder of Facebook, who a lot of people don't know about. It's just Mark Zuckerberg, right? But no, Moskovitz is important to pay attention to because he essentially runs open philanthropy, which bankrolled, for example, Event 201 before the COVID-19 crisis.
Wow.
Among numerous other things. These are people that are not to be ignored, and they increasingly dominate the thought behind the people creating AI right now.
So you've talked before about the use of cybersecurity and a cybersecurity event to bring on the CBDCs and the kind of control system. Mm-hmm. And we know we've seen several scenario plannings by, we saw one by the IMF in Israel and another one recently. So tell us a little bit about why you think cybersecurity is going to be the event bringing or the sort of the false flag of bringing in CBDCs.
Well, I haven't looked at it so much since April or May, maybe. Part of that because of all the stuff that's happened with my youngest child lately. But up until that point, it seemed very clear to me that is the case. for several reasons. So the most recent, I guess, is that at the WEF annual meet, or World Economic Forum annual meeting in January, you had the number two guy at the WEF under Klaus Schwab, of course, saying that before 2025, there's going to be a massive cyber attack that changes the internet forever. And, you know, the WEF has been pretty right about that kind of stuff lately, and of course is known for large simulations with a variety of public and private actors called Cyber Polygon, which has sort of been a source of fear-mongering at times in independent media. But I think really, you know, a lot of people assumed that it was going to happen before. But ultimately, the only way I think they can fulfill what they want to fulfill, at least as it relates to the internet, is with some sort of massive false flag that makes people willing to eliminate the ability to be anonymous online or to have online privacy. So they have to manufacture consent for that. And it's likely that some sort of cyber terror event, some sort of cyber 9/11 will check the boxes of that, because there is a massive push at the WEF through the WEF Partnership Against Cybercrime, which I've written a lot about for several years. And it's very important to pay attention to that if you are in the US, because the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the Secret Service are all part of it. And in addition to national security or law enforcement agencies, it's the big banks. And then some big tech companies here and there, but it's mainly law enforcement and banking that's on the Partnership Against Cybercrime. And that's very important, especially when you start to look at some of these information sharing and analysis centers called ISACs. The Financial Services ISAC has been planning with the Carnegie Endowment, the WEF PAC, and by the way, the Carnegie Endowment at the time this planning was going on was run by William Burns, who is now CIA director. That's very important. And then in the mix too, you have the Federal Reserve, the ECB, the SWIFT network, all of these guys since 2021 have been saying that there's going to be a massive cyber attack on the financial world. So it seems very likely that they're going to try, as they often do, kill two birds with one stone. There's going to be a massive hack of the financial services industry, of the banks, and they can blame the impending economic unraveling, which is speeding up and everyone knows it's inevitable in a relatively short time frame. They can blame it on faceless hackers, and the banks don't have to take any responsibility. Right. Because of course they don't want a repeat of 08, do they? No, they don't. Right. And so they've been planning for a controlled demolition of the economic system. The dollar has to be liquidated and reborn as the digital dollar. And, you know, they have to, you know, move away from the Bretton Woods system to whatever this new system is going to be that, you know, revolves around CBDCs and the BIS, right? So how do they do that? Faceless cyber attackers, you can literally say, attribute blame to anyone you want, any country, any group, it doesn't matter. And they can say, look what this group has done. You can no longer access your money. They've collapsed the economy. We have to come in, and you have, if you want to access the internet, you have to have a digital ID to get online. And then once that happens, everything online is tied to your digital ID and exactly who you are. And they know what you're looking at and what you're saying. And AI manages all of it.
Right. So So let's go back to your magnificent two-volume work, One Nation Under Blackmail, and a look at all the Epstein networks. Interestingly enough, we know that one of the things Epstein was financing, as was Madoff, was brain research.
Yes.
Very interesting. But we also just saw a change in control at OpenAI that involved bringing a lot of Epstein players onto the board. I was shocked when I saw the new board members. I thought, oh, the first thing I thought of was Bob Rubin bringing Epstein to the White House. And basically, here's Rubin's number two guy coming in to sit on the board of OpenAI.
Well, who was also very close with Epstein in his own right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And but also you're clearly seeing the presence of Harvard Endowment and Harvard Corporation money that was up to its eyeballs in that whole situation all along. And in fact, is if you had to ask me who's the number one purveyor of disaster capitalism in America, you know, they would be in my top three picks. So suddenly they appear on OpenAI board. So talk to us a little bit about, we have this military industrial big tech complex in Silicon Valley, but we're watching the whole Epstein network deeply, deeply fused with that.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Well, you know, as I note in my book, Epstein, after his sexual blackmail operation sort of fell apart, and even before then was getting very involved with big tech, as was Ghislaine Maxwell. And, you know, as I note there, I think a big part of this is the fact that data harvesting replaces the need for any sort of sexual blackmail operation with a lot less risk. Right. So that's where it's all gone. And so, you know, there's the interest in getting involved with big tech for the purpose of blackmailing people, maybe sexually and maybe other ways, but it's ultimately about control at the end of the day. And it's no coincidence that back when Epstein and Ghislaine were running a sexual blackmail operation, you had Robert Maxwell involved with things like the Promise Software scandal and Kissinger also. Which was basically a massive coup of every intelligence agency of the world by the US and Israel.
Right.
And, you know, they got a backdoor into every intelligence agency pretty much in the whole world. Almost all of them back in the 80s. Right.
Right.
And so, you know.
And there's also a question about how many banks they got a backdoor into.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think it's fair to say it's probably most of them, if not all of them, because, you know, as I've noted in other work, the people that created the biggest banks in the U.S. as they are today and that even still run them today were placed there by the Epstein network, essentially, or the people behind Epstein, really, who are at another level. Because we have to keep in mind, too, that Epstein really is more of like a middle management figure.
Right.
He's sort of in the middle of a web, but he's not the top of that web at all. He's working for people.
So many years ago,
Jamie Dimon's working for those same people,
right?
You know,
many years ago, I emailed the head of public relations at all 12 Fed banks, including the New York Fed, and said, who manages your databases and information infrastructure? And do your members have access to that data? And they all wrote back to a man and said, that is confidential information.
I'm sure it is. There's a lot that the Fed is quite tight-lipped about these days. I mean, even with the FTX scandal, you know, there was this very small rural bank in Washington that was a big part of that story.
Yep.
Very shady, called Farmington State Bank. And the Fed approved it when they should not have approved it. And everyone has pointed out that it was very suspect the way it was approved. And they will still not comment on how it was approved. But they I guess, sued Farmington State Bank, even though they approved it. I mean, just stuff that makes no sense, but they won't talk about it and they don't want to talk about it. And there's a lot of things like that with the Federal Reserve. But anyway, you know, if you consider that the Federal Reserve system is dominated by the New York Fed, which I think is the theory that makes the most sense. And then the New York Fed is dominated by Citigroup and JP Morgan. And both of those banks are dominated in a lot of ways by Dimon and the crowd behind him, because, you know, Dimon comes in and the person leading Citigroup, or at least chairman of the board, is Robert Rubin.
Right.
And then Sandy Weill built that with Jamie Dimon before Dimon leaves and then eventually becomes head of JP Morgan. I mean, they're very intertwined banks. In terms of their executive leadership over the last several decades. And that's who's running the Fed. And as I mentioned earlier, and as I have a pretty extensive piece about this, you know, the rise of Jamie Dimon and those two banks is very much interlocked with the same network that was behind Epstein, whether it's the Crown family or Wexner, Leslie Wexner. You know, there's a lot of overlap there. And there's also a lot of overlap with that network in Silicon Valley. It's no coincidence that every big tech titan had some sort of very significant relationship with Epstein.
Right.
And this gets glossed over all the time. The Google co-founders.
Larry Page was in hiding. Wasn't he in hiding?
I think he's still in hiding, actually.
To avoid the subpoena.
Even though the case has been settled. You know, there was a big settlement there with the Virgin Islands. But yeah, both Google co-founders subpoenaed in that. Elon Musk subpoenaed in that. the LinkedIn guy, Reid Hoffman, also very tied up with that. Mark Zuckerberg knew Epstein. Jeff Bezos was very close to Ghislaine and had a relationship with Sotheby's when it was run by Wexner and involved Ghislaine Maxwell also to a significant degree. And that helped put Amazon on the map and all of this. You know, there's they've been intertwined for a long time, and there's very little interest in pursuing what that relationship actually means. And Epstein was very interested in AI, not just mapping the human brain and all of this stuff through his very generous donations to MIT and Harvard, but also a big interest in AI and also getting children in the US Virgin Islands to run AI algorithms and design them for him through his Southern Trust company, which had contracts with the Edmund de Rothschild group and all, you know, all other sorts of weird things going on with that company. No interest by the mainstream media in getting to the bottom of that, or the Google connection. Why does Google have a massive data center in New Albany, Ohio, which on land that is owned by Wexner, Epstein helped create it as well. Is on like the incorporation papers and all of this, along with Jack Kessler, who's one of the people that has worked for Wexner for a long time and helped get Jamie Dimon in at what is now JP Morgan.
So basically, what we're talking about here is a combination of a criminal syndicate and the deep state getting control of a combination of powerful tools that give them complete control.
Yes. And a lot of people, you know, I think there's been some problems with terms for people in as far as the audience of independent media goes, because people will hear a term like deep state, and I don't think a lot of people can even define it anymore. They're just like deep state bad, right? But essentially, you know, we have this blob. I call it a blob, but it's probably not the best term either. But it's really Silicon Valley, it's the banks, and it's the national security state. Those are the biggest players, and they're running everything, and they have for a long time. And they control essentially every politician, even the ones that frame themselves as anti-establishment or as anti-deep state. And this includes Trump.
One of the reasons they do is they have the ability to apply covert violence with impunity.
Exactly.
You know, they poison, they kill, you know, they control and very, they operate above the law, including with weaponry and physical violence.
I mean, they're the mob. That's a lot of what my book is about. This is what the mafia, the mob of yesteryear has become. By, you know, taking over the government, taking over the intelligence agencies, corporate America. And it wasn't really a hostile takeover. In a lot of cases, it was a collaborative takeover. Let's work together and make a lot of money. and, you know, the corruption, there's never been any accountability for it. So after decades and decades and decades, the criminals are in charge and have been in charge for a long time.
So you... I want to bring up one other point about AI. I just finished reading a book I was telling you about called Atlas of AI by Kate Crawford. And it's fascinating. And it starts off by looking at the hardware infrastructure that you need to have an AI system, because you need everybody to have a smartphone. You need cables everywhere. You need computers everywhere. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you look at the hardware infrastructure and electrical grid that needs to go in before you can start to make this thing universal, it's huge. Now, I knew the environmental impact of that hardware infrastructure was bad, especially if you look at crypto. It's ridiculous.
It's very bad.
I had no idea how bad it was. This is the most frightening environmental. I've never read about anything as environmentally damaging as this.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things she goes into is all the lithium mining that we need for Tesla's batteries.
I live in Chile. Know all about it.
Yeah, no, you know all about
Chile
it.
Chile has the largest lithium deposits in the world. So, yeah.
So, you know. But the environmental damage that is coming off of this stuff is just frightening. And it's one of the reasons there's no way you can keep this going for 8 or 9 billion people. They have to depopulate. It's environmentally.
They have to depopulate. That's true.
They have to depopulate. If they want, this machinery is so resource and energy expensive. And what's interesting is if you look at other systems like pricing systems that are not resource don't require a lot of resources and aren't anywhere near as energy expensive. You know, the only reason you would do this one is central control, because it's totally uneconomic. It totally makes no sense.
Yeah.
And if you look at the environmental damage, it has to lead to genocide. Has to.
It's not even just the environmental damage. So if you're, you know, just looking at like the economics of electric vehicles and just the amount of supplies on the planet to produce electric vehicles, there's not enough lithium or cobalt to give everyone an electric vehicle. I mean, they'd be lucky to get all of, like half of China with an electric vehicle. So if everyone's going to have electric vehicles and only, you know, a small poor, a billion people, right, can have one, obviously, you know, there's a lot of pressure built in to this system as they're developing it based on the technologies and what those like technologies require to run. That means that, you know, essentially puts the number that they want to reduce it to at, you know, 1 to 2 billion, if not less. We're definitely at a lot more than that. And so I think it's clear that there's going to be, you know, mass crises manufactured in terms of the food supply, supply chain stuff, and then getting people onboarded to these humanitarian assistance programs that are managed by AI. You want to see what that system is? Look up the Building Blocks Program at the World Food Program. Exactly what it is. Millions of people every day in the world already depend on it to eat. Most recently having onboarded millions in Ukraine alone, because of the conflict. I'm sure Gaza will be next, when the smoke clears there. Since Naftali Bennett, who was running Israel not that long ago, on the Ben Shapiro show on Sunday, overtly said that the first step is to put a technocratic government in charge of Gaza after the conflict ends. This is the model for everywhere where there will be a conflict. And I'm sure, you know, the powers that be have no problems at all engineering conflicts wherever they want. They do it all the time, right? So, this particular program, you have to scan your eye, right? It's biometric, just like WorldCoin, Sam Altman's other venture, aside from OpenAI. It's all about biometrics and tying your access to food rations, to a digital ID and digital wallet. And, you know, you get paid in crypto to the digital wallet, and then you scan your eye at the supermarket. And then it subtracts what you have bought from your digital wallet automatically. And again, you know, this is how the UN is doing all its humanitarian aid pretty much now. And this is how it's going to be. And that's how India runs their digital ID humanitarian aid. And it's the model. And it's run on the Ethereum blockchain at the moment.
So, you know, anytime I doubt the hubris of these folks, when I started to review the environmental impact of this stuff and what they're really up to, and realized that they're literally saying cows are the problem. What you realize is one of the reasons they don't expect the human race is that people believe this stuff, you know, at which point they think they can do and say anything. Okay, so let me just go to the final point here, and that is, I think we come in at different directions, but we're both optimists that this vision of control is going to fail. Mm-hmm. So I think it's fair to say you think it's going to fail. So tell us why you think it's going to fail.
I think it's going to fail for a few reasons. One of which is, you know, we talked about touched on, you know, the culture of corruption that has led us to where we are globally today in the corporate world and also in government. And that same mechanism is true for the AI industry. When you have crony capitalism leading the charge creating these companies and these businesses under a model that's not actually free market economics and the way these companies, you know, it theoretically should be run, you're going to get inferior products. And they're putting AI in charge of stuff that this AI is not actually capable of doing. There's a lot of overhyping in the AI industry.
Right.
There's also a lot of problematic, a lot of them aren't, the AIs oversell how accurate they are, the companies do. So one example is during COVID in Rhode Island, the governor of Rhode Island, who's now in charge of the Department of Commerce under Biden, put an Israeli tech company in charge of using HHS for Rhode Island data to determine when COVID outbreaks would happen before they happen, you know, predicting when the next COVID outbreak would be and where. And this particular company says that their AI is 73% accurate. And that's the company's own statistic. It's never been independently audited. So the odds are it's much less than that, right? And that the highest they could say it was in their marketing material was 73. So with all likelihood, it probably actually hovers around 50%, which is no better than flipping a coin. Right. Is there going to be an outbreak there? Don't know. So a lot of these systems don't actually have a good product as far as AI goes, but it's a product that, you know, just like because of how the world works today, including in the US, you know, it's all about who you know and if you're part of the cabal or not, right?
Right.
So all these connected companies, you know, sure, they can get the contracts, but is their product superior? In a lot of cases, it's not, right?
Right.
So the way they have things set up, and like we've talked about, you know, wanting to put AI in charge of governance, wanting to put AI in charge of this and that, there's going to be a lot of kinks in these systems, and they're not going to really work out well. And I think one of the risks they run, I mean, just think about it, going to like a cashless society, for example. You know, I live in Chile, the third world. And, you know, I'll try and pay with, a card sometimes. I obviously prefer cash, but, you know, sometimes it's just whatever. And, you know, the machine will freeze up or, you know, their system at the grocery store that they have all their checkout stuff on will collapse. Okay. So, you know, that kind of stuff happens and it will happen with these new systems too. And if, you know, I think it's likely that people will be like, actually, this stuff sucks. Why don't we just make our own system or do something different? You know, that right. may happen on a mass scale, or people may be like, you know what, this actually, I don't really like this. You know, I mean, so the idea for them, the powers that be, is to herd people into these systems through convenience or marketing that it's convenient. But what if all the grift that this industry is built upon to a large degree, not entirely, but to a large degree, ends up making it not convenient in many cases. And then what will people do? Well, if the convenience isn't there, they're going to look for something else and they're going to use something else. And then, of course, you know, there's people that are actually aware of what the system is and eager to resist and develop alternatives. But I think, unfortunately, that's a much smaller number. And I hope with time it grows larger. But again, you know, there's a lot of education to do about divesting from big tech because, you know, honestly, without the smartphone, none of this is going to work. The more people who can dump their smartphones and, you know, create market right. demand for dumb phones or going back to something before, I mean, that would have a huge impact. Truly right. huge. Or just divesting from Microsoft Word or Google Business Suite. I cannot tell you how many independent media organizations rely on Google Business Suite that should not rely on Google Business Suite. Right. You know, time to get off Google Docs. It's convenient, but it's not that convenient, you know?
Right.
I mean, choices have to be made and people have to take responsibility for their own stuff. But anyway, sort of a rambling answer. I think there's also another reason we touched on earlier why this will fail, and that ultimately the gambit of this is to control and replace human consciousness. And again, these are the most unconscious people on the entire planet. and they're highly convinced of their own superiority and their godliness or godlikeness. Or that they'll be able to achieve that with this technology. And I don't think that's going to work either.
I believe the universe is intelligent, and it's remarkable that they think you can create a suite of tools that's going to be more intelligent than the universe. And especially because universe intelligence can get into the machines and change what's going on.
Well, this was what I was trying to say earlier about the discussion of materialism. They view the universe as material, not as a living, intelligent thing.
Right.
And right. there's the big difference there. They think the universe is something that they can just manipulate and that, you know, the human mind is just really a biocomputer connected to this easy to manipulate universe that they see as material and essentially inert, not as a living, intelligent thing.
Right.
Right. So again, I think that misunderstanding is going to be very fatal for them. What worries me, of course, is how much damage they do in the meantime in terms of population reduction and environmental destruction.
they can do huge damage.
Yeah.
And that's why the sooner everybody understands how nuts this whole thing is, the better. So do you, Whitney, do you think they're going to try and use the digital ID to stop the general population from being able to access open source AI so that they have a monopoly on AI?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think that is inherent with this coming attack on the internet, which is aimed at eliminating online anonymity and financial privacy. They go together.
Right. Right.
So as soon as they do that, I think what they will be doing, because I mean, it's on the books, is to have what they tried to do in the Obama administration. They called it a driver's license for the internet. You would need a digital ID to access the internet through your internet service provider or ISP. Right. And they would throttle you there. No way to get on through the internet service provider without the digital ID. And right. I mean, most of the ISPs in the US already, right, are monopolies, and elsewhere, right, it's pretty much the same as well.
Right.
Right. And, you know, yeah, I mean, that, of course, makes it more difficult. There are a lot of efforts in the broader freedom tech movement to try and allow this stuff to be accessible, and it's going to rely on alternative systems. And so anyone with money to throw around should definitely consider supporting developers creating that infrastructure.
Yes.
Because
absolutely,
it's going to be very needed, and a lot of people aren't thinking about it. And if you believe the World Economic Forum timeline of before 2025, that's a year from now, roughly. So
right,
a lot to think about. And so, you know, even for regular people who maybe don't have that kind of capital or don't have any sort of developer programming knowledge, I think the most important thing is to do a much smaller scale version of what some of these people in charge are doing. Harvest data off the internet. What do I mean by that? Everything useful, knowledge, important information, survival skills. There's, you know, essentially the internet has become the Library of Alexandria of today. And when
right,
they take it down and bring it back, it's not going to be the same, right?
Right.
So now is the time within the next year to take off everything you could possibly ever need of the internet as it is now that you might want
right,
for the future. Ebooks,
right,
you know, videos you like on that you find useful and informative, whether they're on YouTube or wherever, it's time to start building your own library from
right,
what the internet is.
Right.
Because if you won't be able to access it in the future, that alternative architecture isn't there in time. You know, even if the alternative architecture is there in time, it'll be much smaller than the internet is today, because the internet is ultimately a network, a very large network of interconnected computers. So
right,
people not on that internet, it's obviously going to be smaller, right?
Right. That's good advice.
So definitely have to be proactive about getting what you can out of the internet as it is now while it's still here, because they're not going
right,
to let it stay the way it is now. And
right,
this also necessitates that we think about, you know, what that means for independent media and also how people will communicate going forward. Time to think about being less reliant on their systems for communicating with, you know, journalists, content creators, and friends, whoever, associates, in this paradigm where, you know, if you're not going to get a digital ID, like yourself and me, and hopefully everyone watching this, going to have to think about what we will do so we don't have to interact with that system.
Right. So it's back. Yeah. We've been looking into mesh networks, but, you know, we could also get to the point where it's got to be, we've got to have node systems that are a bicycle ride away. You know, I used to mail cassettes, and there used to be newsletters that would mail cassettes, but I'm not planning on the post office working mm-hmm, either. So we'll see. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, you shouldn't, but again, this needs to be thought through, and people need to be thinking about it now and making
yes,
plans about what they will do when that time comes now.
Right.
Definitely.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and these guys are going to try that. They've been very clear.
They have
to,
though. Yeah.
Right. Well, they can't, you can't continue to depopulate without that kind of control.
Yeah. They have to keep people from talking to each other around the world about what's happening where they are, especially given the fact that in order to get us from where we are now to where they want us to go, there have to be a series of manufactured crises. And they don't
right,
want what's been happening over the past several years to continue happening. It was a problem for them with COVID in a big way. And,
right,
you know, at least, you know, where I live in Chile, for example, a lot of regular people fell hook, line, and sinker for the COVID narrative. But now they're like, if they do this again, no way I'm, you know, doing any of this. Right. Which is, you know, obviously positive for me living here. Right. But definitely not positive for them. And so they're seeking to bottleneck all of that stuff. So the only information people have access to is information they develop or that the generative AI they control develops.
So we're having a huge war in Europe because countries are trying to not go along with the WHO amendments. And if you look at the WHO amendments and the WHO treaty, it's basically an amazing tool to assert control of people and places. So if you wanted, you know, to me, it's the most elegant real estate confiscation scheme I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But if you combine it, of course, with CBDCs and digital IDs and then AI, then you're talking about an amazing ability to control places. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and that's why.
And not just that, there's the whole carbon credit, privatizing and tokenizing nature element to all of that as well. So it's very extensive.
Every faction is competing to deliver the most central control, and all of them together. That's why I think ultimately they'll kill each other, because it's just, you see it all coming in and it's.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable. Anyway,
well, also, okay. You know, a big word here for all of these systems is interoperability. And a lot of these systems, as they've been built, are not interoperable yet. And in some cases, they're struggling to make it interoperable. So right. That's interesting. We'll see how right. that but goes.
Of course, when they all click in, they got to fight over the fee flow. So and there's not enough for everybody. Watch.
Of course.
Okay, so we're going to publish. I've got the draft right here. I'll just show it. We're going to publish this with this interview. So definitely check out The AI Revolution, The Final Coup d'Etat by Whitney Webb. Any other thoughts before we close that we haven't covered, Whitney, that you'd like to bring up?
Well, I think I've already touched on most of it, but I just want to really drive home the importance of taking responsibility for the tech you use and divesting from big tech as much as possible. On my website, Unlimited Hangout, we have sort of like a beginner's guide of how to get off big tech operating systems, alternatives to things you probably use that are big tech dominated to lead you towards open source tech, non-big tech alternatives to all of these things. That has to begin now. And right. Of course, it's a little hard. It might be a little harder than using what you have right now, but they're counting on us to not take that step, right? And we must. It is a thing that has to happen if we're not going to be pushed into this corral. Do not wait too long to make these choices.
One of the things I'll tell you is that the more you get open source and the more you get off of this stuff, the less creepy it feels. Mm-hmm. You know, it all comes with, you know, it comes with a certain kind of convenience, but it comes with a really horrible creep factor. So
yeah,
I can't recommend it enough. It's worth it. It's worth the transition.
So some people will say things like, oh, well, even if you use open source tech, they can still surveil you. Yes, of course, they still can. But the point is, and I think people overlook this too, you know, they can't turn off your access to that technology if it's not theirs. Like maybe they can get in and see what data is coming in and out, but they can't be like, okay, you know, Google, think of Google and the Google account, right? That ties together your YouTube and your Gmail and your Android operating system on your phone. And they decide to lock you out of a Google account. You can't use any of that stuff anymore, right? Or same with Microsoft, which now says your data isn't actually your data. And we're going to close off your Microsoft account whenever. And then you can't access any of your information anymore. It's essentially ours, right?
Right.
So that's a big part of it too. It's not just, oh, I'm going to be surveillance proof. I mean, we know that they have invested a lot of money in trying to surveil literally everything. And I think it's very fair to not really have any illusions of privacy anymore. But that being said, we still have to divest from it. Even if you're like, oh, who cares? They'll still see what I'm doing. It's not about that necessarily. You know,
right.
There's a lot of other components to it with them being able to take your access to that technology away being a big one, but not the only one.
We forgot to bring up China, the China boogeyman. Can we just spend 5 minutes on the China boogeyman?
Absolutely.
Okay. The China boogeyman is if we don't do it, China will. So we've got to be better than China because otherwise China will control.
So the Schmidt Kissinger crowd and, of course, the other Silicon Valley crowd led by Peter Thiel and Elon Musk, you know, they have very different approaches to this question, I guess, in terms of rhetoric, but it's essentially the same at the end of the day. So Eric Schmidt led the National Security Commission on AI, and essentially, because it's a National Security Commission, they frame everything that they feel needs to be done with AI, policy-wise, as necessary to do to beat China. But at the same time, Henry Kissinger, I mean, the number two guy under Xi Jinping, has a framed picture of Kissinger in his office, right? I mean, these guys are pals behind the scenes. Elon Musk on the Peter Thiel, like, oh, China... China's bad and we should never collaborate with them. Make America great again side. Yeah. So Elon Musk, I mean, China is hugely invested in Tesla and any other number of his companies. He wants to make Twitter or X, WeChat, and the parent company of WeChat is the most active shareholder in Tesla. I mean, it's just very silly to think that these guys don't interact with each other. But that being said, you know, this idea that we have to become China to beat China is very prominent in national security circles, right? And it's essentially led in terms of like the ideological architecture, it's Schmidt and Kissinger. And it's no surprise there with Kissinger, because he's the guy that was the face of the opening up of China during the Nixon administration and all of this, and has had decades and decades of being very closely interfaced with their leadership and their opening up to American and global enterprise and all of that over the past several decades. And, you know, basically, the way Kissinger and Schmidt frame it is like, you know, in the National Security Commission on AI, this is in their documentation too, as I've written about before, you know, we can either be at odds with China and have a big war that'll kill everybody, or we can collaborate on AI together with China and build essentially the same system, which is really what's happening. I mean, the overlap between Silicon Valley and the Chinese equivalent of Silicon Valley is very considerable. And, to bring Israel, which we mentioned earlier in the discussion, you know, back, Israel has been, in terms of technology, including military technology, very much in between the U.S. and China, developing very deep relationships with both sides since the late 70s. Even before they had formal diplomatic relations with China, which I think for Israel was like the early 90s, you know, it's been very, very closely linked for a long time. On both sides. And, you know, I think, you know, at the superficial level that like people, the public is meant to see, it's meant to look like a very antagonistic relationship. But, you know, I note this to an extent in my book and talking about some of the stuff with Clinton and China that Epstein was tangentially involved in the 1990s and what led to that, just an insane amount of overlap and American elites, particularly in the corporate world, really seeking to guide how China industrialized and grew, and maintaining a big foothold in terms of influence, you know, over those decisions within China for a long time. So, you know, that central control model that China is today would not exist without the influence of a lot of these American figures, to say the very least. And if you look at people like Anthony Blinken's stepfather, Samuel Pisar, he is like the most insane soft disclosure guy I think I've ever come across, because he told Congress in the early 70s that what was taking over the world was the trans ideological corporation, his term. And he was saying that the corporate world of the West, of the United States, and the corporate, the state-owned enterprises of the communist world, China and Russia, were fusing and coming together to create a global, essentially a global governance structure that would not be influenced by national governments, and that the national government was becoming irrelevant.
Wow, that is a remarkable soft disclosure.
Yeah, and he was asked, do you think this trans ideological corporation model is evil? And he was like, no, mostly good, you know. And that's Anthony Blinken's stepdad, Robert Maxwell's top confidant, best friend, and lawyer. But of course, a lot of other things. Lawyer for Occidental Petroleum, lawyer and major advisor to Steve Jobs while he was building Apple, among numerous other companies. And essentially what we've had since then is an effort to create a college of corporations between East and West, under the guise of resolving and finding peace in the Cold War, you know, this transnational flow, you know, people that control the capital transnationally dominating everything. And they're the mob. And this same group that was right. developing all of this with, you know, that PSAR was a part of, have people from the Chicago mob, the New York right. mob on the board, right?
Right. It's so, a mob. You know, it, the whole thing's yeah. a mob. Right. So one thing I want to point out is if you look at the extraordinary investment in AI in the US, in China and Israel, if you look at everybody else, you know, they are so far ahead in percentage terms, in mm-hmm. terms of number of people and amount of yep. money and number of patents and everything else. It makes you wonder what the world is going to look like if it's so dominated by these three players.
Yeah, well, I think you can already see how it's going to turn out, because if countries that are ostensibly turning away from the United States are turning towards China, because what's the alternative, right?
Right.
So you have the multipolar world that's dominated by BRICS, which BRICS is dominated by China. And then you have the United States Western power block, right? So every country on the planet is either largely affiliated with one or the other, or try and balance the two.
Right.
And, you know.
But if you look at the G20 meeting, which umbrellaed all of them, mm-hmm. they came out clearly for a central CBDC and digital ID system mm-hmm. together.
And Agenda 2030 and the sustainable right. development goals, they right. agree on it all. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, the materialists are all coming together in a concentrated form, and we'll see what happens, because somehow I think life will reject them. We want to make sure everybody listening to this thrives and survives the process.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Again, the key to thriving is making a decision to not be a part of this and thinking about how to not be of a part of it, and then right. executing that plan.
Right.
That's what it comes exactly. down to. And it's very feasible. Like, as you mentioned earlier, the alternatives to their technology better than they've ever been, and they'll continue to get better, but they require investment from people with right. the capital to get better in this short time frame. Right. But also, you know, just for people to start using it, because the more users they have, you know, the more market share it will have, the more it will spread by word of mouth and what have you. And the more people will be not using big tech, because yeah. they don't expect people to not be dependent on them. They require that dependency, and they want to deepen that dependency. Right. So the way to not be part of their system and dependent on them is to become, of course, independent of them. How are we going to do that? It's time to think about it.
Right.
And do it.
Make sure you have a good bicycle. Okay, Whitney Webb, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. We know how busy your time is these days. If there's anything we can do to be of assistance, please let us know.
Thanks so much.
We are deeply appreciative of your work. You make it easy to see the world the way it really is. And, you know, of course, that's the doorway you have to walk through to get to real solutions. So, I'll just say it again. You know, I want you to get a hold of AI, the AI revolution, the final coup d'etat. But I also want you to go buy Whitney's. But if you don't have it for your library, it's an essential, you know, once they lock us out of the internet, that is an essential testament in hard copy to what was really going on. So get the 2-volume copy of One Nation Under Blackmail. How can they find it? Tell us how we can find your work and sign up and stay connected.
Well, I've done my best to make it pretty easy for people to find all my stuff in one place. So that would be my website, unlimitedhangout.com. From there, you can purchase the book. From there, you can find pretty much all of my work, unless it was published at Mint Press, but some of it's been, of course, republished on my site. You can sign up for my newsletter there. I will not be on Twitter X until after this year, because they're going to go to automatic, you know, required verification. We'll not be doing that. And, you know, I'm going to, you know, get off PayPal and some of this other stuff at the end of the year as well. But everything about, really about, you know, my content, staying in touch, the book, all of it, you can find it on limitedhangout.com.
Okay. Whitney Webb, have a wonderful day. Thank you again for joining us on the Solaria Report.